Переговоры нормандской четверки в Минске бьют рекорды.
По словам президента, удалось договориться о главном. Огонь
Украина вроде бы получает контроль над всей границей с Россией.
Буквально с минуты на минуту его должны лично подписать Путин, Меркель, Алант и Порошенко.
После 16 часов переговоров в полдень по московскому времени президент...
Понятно, что Украина останется унитарным государством и ни о какой федерации...
Three presidents and a chancellor pulled an all-nighter in Minsk. And the ceasefire agreement they produced just might end the fighting in Donbass. But what it does not do is resolve the issue at the heart of the year-long conflict in Ukraine. And what it explicitly does not do is prevent Russia from continuing to intervene in Ukraine's affairs. In fact, if anything, the long hand of Moscow may have just gotten longer and stronger.
Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFVRL. And with me in the studio here is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFVRL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Welcome, Natalia.
Hello, thank you.
And joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, all.
And joining us from Bonn, Germany, is Andreas Umland, a professor of Russian and Ukrainian history at Kyiv-Mohyla Academy and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kyiv. Welcome back, Andreas.
Hello, Brian.
Well, writing in Bloomberg, the political commentator Leonid Bershitsky called the Minsk agreement a time bomb wrapped in a peace agreement that is, quote, as close to a deal on Putin's terms as decency allows. Mark, let's start with you. Do you agree? I want to get all of your opinion on that, but let's start. Is this an agreement on Putin's terms?
To an extent, but only to an extent. I mean, obviously, the problem is that once you get heads of state into a room together, particularly Western heads of state, need to have some kind of an agreement. They can't walk out really with failure. And Putin realized that and therefore was willing to leverage that to get a deal that is very much, I think, to his advantage. But I think we ought to also accept that this is not a done deal in any way. First of all, there's many chances for Putin's proxies to mess this up and allow them to become sort of regarded as the bad guys. And it's worth sort of mentioning in passing that for someone who apparently has absolutely no stake in this war and no forces on the ground or anything like that, it's interesting that Putin is the one who's actually making the deal for the rebels. But the second thing is, I mean, this is just the start of a process. This is as it were, two things. It's two deals in one. It's meant to be a ceasefire. We'll see if that happens. And then it's also a roadmap for a future political settlement. And in a way, yeah, the future political settlement would be very advantageous to Putin. But in many ways, I think from Kiev's point of view, it's the ceasefire element that is the most important bit. Mm-hmm.
Natalia, what was your take? I know we were talking off mic yesterday and you shared my open skepticism about this.
Well, I think we can discuss the deal in details and look at the how many kilometers they're going to be separated apart and things like that. But I think on that we will be wasting a lot of time because really for Kyiv the most important thing is the ceasefire, and all the rest in Kyiv I don't think they will ever be expecting the other side to fulfill, because we've already seen what happened to the previous Minsk agreements, that they were not respected from day one. And I think this one, we already hear what Putin says, that Russia is not part of the agreement, that Russia is only a guarantor, and things like the exchange of prisoners, only the prisoners who are on the Ukrainian territory, which means that whatever Poroshenko said yesterday about the Ukrainian pilot captain Russian in Moscow, in the Russian prison, is not about her. So there are a lot of interpretations that both sides went out of the from Minsk disagreeing upon. So they have absolutely different interpretations of the document, and having that kind of document on which you disagree on what is already written, mm-hmm. I think there's very little hope.
So the main thing was getting a ceasefire, and the rest is just window dressing. Would that be a correct way to characterize it?
Well, I think Ukraine is not an independent player in this case. It has. What it needs now is the money, and I don't think it's a coincidence that the IMF announced the exact amount of money that they're going to release to Ukraine this year and in the future on the same day that they had the ceasefire. So to have any kind of meaningful economic reform and functioning country, you need a ceasefire. You need to stop the war, and I think that was the main idea with which Kyiv came to these negotiations. Mm-hmm.
Andreas, what was your take? Was this an agreement on Putin's terms, or was it something else?
One can read it in different ways. There was a statement from an employee of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, Dmytro Kuleba, who actually presented the agreement as a victory for Ukraine. And if you read the agreement, it doesn't look as bad. It actually, if it were implemented, it would mean that Ukraine would basically, at least mainland Ukraine, would again become a sovereign state with a special status for the Donbas. But that was basically something also already agreed in September, so there isn't much of a difference to the September Minsk agreements. The main problem that I see is whether the agreement will be implemented to the fullest. And I think the key question here is going to be whether there are going to be democratic elections in the Donbas, to the municipalities, to the local regional parliaments. And if there are such elections, that would probably mean that the separatists would either lose completely power, or they would have to share power with other political forces. But that one cannot imagine that currently happening, because they had already their pseudo elections in late last year, and if such elections would take place, then that would be indeed a solution. And but the question is, of course, how the West will react if the agreement is not implemented. I think Ukraine will try to follow the agreement and change the constitution as demanded from the Ukrainian side. But if there are no democratic elections in the Donbas, then the whole agreement becomes bogus.
Right. Okay, so everybody's, I mean, this is weird. I'm the pessimistic one in a room full of relative optimists, which is a weird place for me to be, because I'm usually the foolish optimist amid a bunch of pessimists. One thing I did want to focus on very briefly is the actual mechanism for assuring the ceasefire itself. Because we all know Minsk I failed. It didn't, and nobody honored it. And this is the one part of the agreement I actually thought was an improvement on Minsk, because you have a wider demilitarized buffer zone. It was 30 kilometers total, if I'm not mistaken, in Minsk I. And this is a total of 50. They have to be 50 kilometers away
both
from each other.
Both sides.
And then 140 for even heavier weapons. What this does, the OSCE says this wider buffer zone gives it the opportunity to monitor, which it didn't have with the narrower buffer zone. I'm going to have to trust them on the technicalities of that, since I'm not a weapons inspector or anything. And it also, very importantly, takes major population centers out of the range of heavy weapons. Mark, you're the military expert here. When you look at this, does this mechanism make this one more likely to be implemented than Minsk I, which was a failure on the ground?
Well, frankly, it's not about the mechanisms. I mean, let's be honest. This is better in terms of, it is more easy, more effective to monitor this particular ceasefire if it starts to happen. And, you know, the OSCE will do their job. The issue is not really, though, I think I would suggest, the technicalities of that. It's more about whether or not it starts in the first place. There's still a couple of days, and it's interesting that the fighting has actually pulsed up since then, clearly.
Although that was
people trying to change. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, changing the sort of the ground truths is always one of these sort of classic tactics. And then there is meant to be a sort of a period in which the heavy weapons are withdrawn. And the risk is that then this becomes one of these sort of games of inverse chicken. You know, I will wait until I see evidence of your artillery being pulled back before I pull back my artillery. But the point is, the artillery really was much more of an issue, frankly, on the Ukrainian side, or rather, you know, it's Ukrainian artillery, which is the key issue, because the rebels, if need be, can move artillery, or that if actually we wouldn't see a real escalation, the Russians could bring in air power, which is unlikely but possible. So my concern is that not that whether or not the nuts and bolts of this deal are workable, they absolutely are. It's whether or not actually it ever really starts to happen on the ground. That's the question. So in some ways, I mean, obviously we're having to talk now because now is the time to talk. It'll be more interesting to see on Monday, Tuesday, or this time next week, whether or not actually the guns have fallen silent and the heavy artillery has been withdrawn. But there's an element in me that almost, and again, the more cynical side of me, is that if you're not planning on following an agreement, but on the other hand, you want the other side to believe you are, then of course you haggle and you look as if you care about the detail. That's what we don't really know. Whether or not the Russian side was willing to accede to a more monitorable ceasefire because it knew full well that it wasn't really going to apply in the first place.
Natalia, what do you think? Do you expect this ceasefire mechanism to work better than Minsk One? What are your expectations?
Well, the problem with the Minsk One was, as Ukrainian commentators presented it, was that it was written in such a way that it was never meant to be implemented, and that you can see on a simple journalistic test of when, where, how, who, and
what
and what exactly. So these things were not written in the Minsk agreement, the first Minsk agreement. They're slightly better, and President Poroshenko expected them to be slightly better this time. But it's really the problem is whether you trust the other side. And in the Ukrainian case, it's very difficult to trust the other side. And you don't really, well, they don't really know who is the other side, if it's the rebels or the Russian generals with whom they are going to draw this line, and then how much the rebels are under control of the Russian generals, that which is another question, which is still we don't know the answer.
No, I mean, I think the other side is clearly Mr. Putin and his ruling circle. And the question for me is whether he wants this ceasefire to work or not. And actually, I'll get to this in a little bit. I think he does want the immediate ceasefire to work, but I'll get to that in a bit. Andreas, what's your take? Do you expect this ceasefire to work?
Yes, I would also rather think that the ceasefire will work because there was so much effort put into it, and all these trips by Merkel and Hollande, the long negotiations. I think the West has now invested a lot into the ceasefire. If it does not work, I think there will be very quickly, so that the West will be ready to intervene with sanctions or even with delivery of arms. For me, the key question will be how the West will behave if the ceasefire works, but the agreement is otherwise not implemented. So if basically this remains a sort of frozen conflict, the separatists remain in power, the border between the separatist regions and Russia remains open, how will the West behave then? Because the West could actually exert much more pressure on Russia. There is a discussion about the SWIFT payment system, about oil imports from Russia into the European Union. So will the West use these instruments to push for a full implementation of the agreement? Because if it is fully implemented, it would actually mean a restoration of Ukrainian sovereignty on mainland Ukraine. But Putin certainly does not want that. He wants to have these regions under at least partial control, and the West has to make up its mind.
Well, I think Putin wants to do here, I've thought a lot about this and talked about it on the Daily Vertical a bit, is Putin is seeking a Bosnia-style solution in Ukraine. Basically, what we have is that strong majorities of Ukrainians are going to clearly continue to elect pro-Western governments. That's been the trend already. And when you take Crimea out of the equation, it accelerates that trend. If you continue to have free and fair elections in Ukraine, Ukraine is going to continue to elect pro-Western governments, and it's going to move farther and farther away from Moscow and closer and closer to Europe. Putin understands this political reality. And given that political reality, if he wants to solve this politically, he has to decentralize or federalize, in his fashionable term, Ukraine to the point of dysfunction. He needs Ukraine to turn into Bosnia-Herzegovina, to have a central government that basically can't do a damn thing. If you want to know what Putin wants Ukraine to look like, imagine Bosnia without the Western influence, but with Russia playing a similar role in Donbass to the one Serbia plays in the Republika Srpska. That's what Putin wants. Well, if war is politics by other means, politics can also be war by other means. And that's what I think this agreement, that's what I fear this agreement allows Putin to do. Because if you look at the text of the agreement, Ukraine does not get control of its border with Russia until it implements this constitutional reform and decentralization of power, giving special status to the certain areas of Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast, the rebel-held areas. Now, decentralization, constitutional reform, even federalization could mean a lot of different things. In the Federal Republic of Germany, federalization is a very democratic thing. In the United States of America, federalization is a very... But in the context right now in Ukraine, it's a recipe for Bosnification. So... if Russia is not happy with the way Ukraine decentralizes, and Ukraine, as Natalia pointed out off mic earlier, has long had its own plans to decentralize and devolve power. But if Russia doesn't get the decentralization it wants while maintaining control of the border, it can always send troops back in. Even if it does pull these troops out, troops they claim they don't even have anyway, they can go right back in. So we're talking about constitutional reform with a gun to your head. For Ukraine, this is my fear right now. This is my greatest fear. I had a sick feeling when I read point 11 on the agreement, which said that the constitutional reform must happen. And I also had a sick feeling when I read that the border doesn't go back to Ukrainian control until they do constitutional reform. So that's my cynical take. Mark, why don't you bring us back down to earth and give us some optimism or something here?
Well, I'm not sure how far it's optimism, but I mean, I think in broad terms, I'd agree with you. I mean, I think I'd have just a couple of sort of nuance elements just to sort of tease out. I mean, first of all, let's just talk about federalization. Absolutely. What does that actually mean? Again, given my own sort of concerns or nefarious interests, I'm interested in things like, well, okay, well, who gets to control local law enforcement agencies?
Well, the this is in the agreement. It's in black and white.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so in effect, you know, we have circumstances in which precisely the sort of the levers of real and effective power could still well be in the hands of dubious local individuals. I wouldn't say that necessarily the aim is to create dysfunction, though dysfunction would also work from Moscow's point of view. I think it's more that the aim of federalization is to ensure that Moscow has a veto. Mm-hmm. It's to ensure that basically... through its proxies in southeastern Ukraine and through this sort of decentralization of the government system, it knows that it can cause so much misery in Kiev politically, just to basically begin to try and house train Kiev. Fine. You know, I mean, anyway, Putin doesn't care if everyone in Ukraine outside of the Donbass loves the West. Putin does care about what actually happens as a result of it. So I think that's a sort of one minor point. And just to sort of throw in another issue, which going back to Andreas's point about, well, okay, who would actually win free and fair elections? The thing about this structure is it cannot be allowed to create a federalized state in which actually the people in the Donbass elect a government that is also pro-Kiev's policies, pro-drift to Europe and so forth.
Which might happen.
Which common sense is exactly what people would want. And certainly, if one looks way back in the days when there wasn't a war, this is not something that boiled out of a sort of a massive and widespread revulsion about the thought of Ukraine drifting Europewards. Okay, opinions clearly have become much more radicalized. It's, you know, once you have the government rather indiscriminately shelling cities in the Donbass, no wonder people get annoyed, and also, you know, other people just simply flee the area. But one way or the other, I mean, we know that Russia cannot allow a genuine, honest, and transparent political system to obtain in the Donbass. So it's not just simply a whether or not it gets a federal structure. It's going to have to basically ensure that it still gets to control these regions. And that, I think, is a basis for potentially some very sort of nasty future shenanigans.
And you think that's a battle Ukraine might be able to win, even if Russia gets its federalization? You think it's possible or no?
No, I mean, I think if it looks as if Ukraine was going to win, if, as it were, the hearts and minds approach was going to work, then the only thing Russia can do, unless it's just willing to say, oh, well, never mind, that was a good try, which I don't really see as the Kremlin's, laid back and relaxed philosophy to these things, is it has to stir things up yet again. It has to send its agents in. It has to create some casus belli to once again say, no, it's clear that this isn't working. We're going to have to try something more. What? So I think the trouble is that, in a way, this might... perhaps, maybe, if we're very optimistic, resolve the current conflict, not that I believe it will. But the point is, the civilizational conflict about the Donbass and thus the future of Ukraine as a whole is still to be played out.
Yeah. I know, and this is why the clause of keeping the border in Russia's hands until constitutional reform happens drove me crazy. That when I read that, I wanted to scream. Natalia,
I think in case of Ukraine and Russia, the main thing that Ukraine wants in the conflict is to control its borders. That's the main thing.
The main principle of sovereignty. I mean, it's the main aspect of sovereignty.
Yes, and what Russia wants, it doesn't want Donbass, it doesn't want other areas, it doesn't want half of Ukraine. It wants to have a control of Ukrainian, not only foreign policy, but mainly its internal policy. And I think this Putin's propaganda line about the association agreement, the European Union and NATO, we all know that this is a lot of hot air, because Ukraine didn't have any realistic chance to get into any of those institutions. So it's not about its foreign policy, it's about its internal policy. And what happens if Ukraine controls its borders in this present situation, where Putin doesn't have his favorite oligarch in charge of Ukraine? Then Ukraine starts to reform, because the internal pressure for reform is immense. It's enormous. And once that happens, once Ukraine controls its borders, it can use its own oligarchs to deal with the with Donbass, with all those Zakharov and other guys. Zakharchenko, sorry. So it's not a question of negotiating anything with them after Ukraine controls its borders, because then it will be very, very easy. Because if Ukraine gives the money, it will be very easy to control this area. And also because the people there, they are all known people in the Ukrainian politics. So it's really, for Ukraine, this border issue is the key issue. And for Russia, of course, it's also the key issue, because otherwise, there is no means it can control Kyiv anymore.
Mm. Andreas, what was your reaction? Do you share my deep fears about this, or do you think I'm overblowing it?
Well, as far as I remember, the term federalization does not appear in the agreement.
No, but decentralization, constitutional reform, and special status all do.
Yeah, but there was already a law adopted back in September or in October by the Verkhovna Rada, granting a special status to these regions for, I think, for a three-year period. And so I think that's something that probably Kyiv would have no problems with. The question is whether there will be elections and whether they will be free and fair. And then that would be also a little bit of a gamble, of course, because we don't know what public opinion is in these regions. My colleague at Tufts University, Oksana Shevel, has just commented on Facebook that she thinks, as a result of the brainwashing campaign, the information manipulation campaign, the separatists could actually win in these free and fair elections. I have my doubts. I think if there were a reasonably fair election campaigning with different parties presenting their candidates, I think they may have some support, but I would still think that the majority would vote for for instance, the opposition bloc or the Communist Party or even for the Poroshenko bloc and even for the Narodny Front of Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Or you would have these sort of pro-European parties, more or less pro-Ukrainian parties having then a majority. But of course, I think it's very difficult to imagine such elections happening. And but I think it's clearly said in the agreement that the OSCE would be monitoring the elections, the Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights that does this. And if we have such elections, I think they would actually solve a lot of issues because they would then create legitimacy for the local representatives of the region. The current representatives are not, or the official representatives are not representative because in the elections, even the Communist Party and the Party of Regions or the opposition bloc could not take part, which were the majority in earlier elections. So once this is solved, or if it is ever solved, I think all other things will fall in place because then the region would have an identity. Perhaps it could also send its deputies then to the Verkhovna Rada, to the national parliament, and that would actually solve the problem. But I fear that these elections will never happen.
Mark is indicating he has something to say.
Yeah, I suppose I find myself torn. On the one hand, I agree entirely with Andreas that, yes, that certainly would solve many things if there were proper democratic elections and so forth. But I think we have to realize what this conflict is. This is not about a region that felt itself politically disenfranchised rising up and saying, no, you must listen to our voice. I mean, this is clearly about geopolitics. This is about a conflict that Moscow engineered for specific geopolitical meanings. So to that end, Moscow cannot allow that kind of a democratic process to take place. It can't allow elections that would even conceivably mean that its agents do not control the region. Because that's the whole point is, from their point of view, they might be willing to accept federalization only insofar as that actually advances their goals. Because Putin doesn't care for a moment whether the people of Donetsk or Luhansk are happy. He doesn't care whether they have a voice or not. If Kiev turned around and said, look, I'll tell you what, you know, we'll swear off any shift towards the east, but you let us actually wipe out the entire population of the Donbass, I can't imagine that it would take any time for Putin to pull out his pen from his pocket and say, I'll sign that. So, I mean, I think, we have to realize that, they're, as it were, almost there
this isn't about the Donbass.
To discussion. Obviously, there are, especially now, issues of how do you reconcile the population of the Donbass within the political system. And there is, of course, a role for domestic politics and so forth. But then there is the separate and really rather more obviously important track of how do you actually reconcile Kiev and Moscow. And there I'm not yet sure that we actually have any real solution.
I don't think they're I think Kiev and Moscow per se are reconcilable. Kiev and this Russian regime are not reconcilable. They're on different planets. But what I'm wondering is, I'd like to hear what Natalia thinks about this. I mean, it's clear that this is written in the agreement that you're going to have democratic elections in the Donbass, and Russia has no intention of letting democratic elections take place. Is it possible this process could slip out of Moscow's control and you do have democratic elections in the Donbass, which, as Andreas pointed out, would probably not produce a monolithic pro-Moscow region. It would produce a mixed bag. You got to remember the Donbass oligarchs are going to be in the picture, spreading their money around, and they're on Kyiv's side right now.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a competitive political process. You're going to have the current so-called leadership of Donetsk and Luhansk sharing power with people that are of a very different political orientation. Can this slip out of Moscow's control, regardless of what their intentions are here?
Well, if they were sure that in any kind of semi-democratic, independently or sovereign democratic or whatever the word they use for democracy in Russian, there would be the process that they could win these elections, they would already happen there. Because I've heard recently about one of the polls where people in Donbass would vote something like 40% for the communists again, and the rest would probably go to the whatever is been reformed party of region, party of Viktor Yanukovych and the oligarchs. So the support for Zakharchenko and people like him would be in low single digits, the same way as it was in Crimea for Mr. Aksyonov, when there was no talk about the Russian annexation of the peninsula. And I think people now in Donbass will only vote for those who will bring their some kind of economic normal economic life, and they know that this area is now seen as a prize for a loser. As a prize for someone who will have to invest very heavily right. in that area. So they know that whoever gets it will have to deal with it economically, and it's going to be very difficult. And I don't think that Russia wants this region, actually, wants to support it. And Putin said it several times already that he doesn't want to support it. So the people there, they're probably going to vote for someone who will be. It doesn't have to be the bloc of Poroshenko, but it will be someone Ukrainian anyway.
But it will be, but it could be the communists and the opposition.
Could be the communists and the opposition. No. But again, the communists, it will be the votes, the people who that's voting with their hearts, not very much with their minds in that case. But the communists didn't get even into the Ukrainian parliament. So they're not going to have very much weight, political right. weight in Ukraine. Given the size of the place, also, we have to understand that it's only less than half of Donbass. Less than half right. of those two areas of two oblasts, which means that whatever decentralization, whatever federalization, which is not in the play anymore, but still, whatever kind of political system that you're going to have in Kyiv, this area is not going to have any blocking power.
Right, and this is what Putin's after. I mean, he's the whole point of decentralization is to give his proxies a disproportionate voice in Kyiv and a veto over Kyiv's direction. And I mean, the optimistic part of me looking at this agreement says, you know, actually, Ukraine could wait this out and beat Putin despite this, what I consider to be a very flawed agreement. And this leads to the last thing I kind of wanted to get at before we move on to the second half. And that is that can Ukraine pursue the long game here and still pursue its goal of European integration, even given all this stuff? Andreas, what do you think?
Well, that's a different issue. I just wanted to comment on the previous issue. I think for me, the interesting point is going to be if Ukraine fulfills its part of the agreement, it changes the constitution, it announces a date for municipal, local elections, regional elections, and then it turns out that an orderly conduct of free and fair elections is not possible. How will the West then react? Because the West has the instruments to pressure Russia much more than it currently does. Mm-hmm. It has used only a small part of its economic leverage. If you look at the Russian state budget, how it's composed. The different issue is, of course, how will Ukraine develop in the meantime? And in a way, this is also the key question about the Donbas. I think the Donbas is for Putin the instrument to deflect attention of the Ukrainian government from internal reform, to create financial constraints, to take away energy, time, and money from what Ukraine should be actually doing. That's implementing the association agreement, reforming, fighting against corruption. I think that's an extremely difficult situation. I'm not even sure there's any example for a country being at war, basically, and making such a profound reform as is now scheduled for Ukraine at the same time. I think the West will have to engage much more actively in Ukraine to give this reform process a chance.
Do you think the IMF plan that was announced yesterday, we were talking about $17 billion, and if I'm not mistaken, $40 billion over 4 years? Mm-hmm. Is that the correct
yes.
figure? Is that enough? I mean, nothing's enough, but is that sufficient to really get Ukraine on its feet? What's everybody's assessment of that?
I think I would say It's a pretty reasonable figure. Obviously, more would always be better, but no, I mean, I think that certainly is enough. But again, you know, what we come down to is this is not a problem that can be bought off. It is exactly a problem that needs to be settled within Ukraine in terms of addressing the crucial governance issues from which pretty much everything else flows. Because, you know, you could waste a lot of that money just in trying to prop up elements of the economy that don't work, as well as with sort of massive embezzlement and so forth. Or that money could precisely be fueling and enabling genuine political and thus economic reform, which is, if we're going to the long game, I mean, if I can just quickly sort of segue to that.
Yeah, no, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I mean, I think there's two long games that potentially Kiev could be playing. One is precisely the political one. That even if you accept, look, the first elections are going to be crooked ones in the Donbass. The first elections, we're going to have to just turn a blind eye while the Russians manipulate and, you know, distort the process, and in some ways almost actually connive at ensuring, you know, because when the OSCE monitors say, well, I'm not sure about this, you know, actually not making a big deal of it. That is possible. They could decide, for the sake of a quiet life, these elections will allow to go and keep Moscow happy. Because let's face it, even if they don't, to go back to Andreas's point, how will the West respond? It's one thing to suggest, oh my gosh, you know, we can't allow war on our border, you know, sort of a country on our borders to take place. It's a lot less sexy to say, look, we're going to have sanctions because the election, the local municipal elections in Donetsk weren't free and fair. You know, I mean, I think Putin rightly is counting on the fact that the West anyway is getting tired of this conflict. This is, you know, this conflict is so 2014. that, you know, the way that the sort of the constant butterfly, you know, of Western political attention is. I mean, I'm amazed and gratified that it's been concentrated on Ukraine for so long. But I do think that if the guns stop, then I do think the West will largely not mm-hmm. be as concerned.
And Moscow's counting on that.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, what can happen is, you know, you could have swallow very dubious elections. For the first few years, not really try anything that is explicitly shifting towards the West, but instead addressing the governance issues, which anyway would need to be addressed before Ukraine would have a hope of being part of any Western institution. But also actually just making Ukraine look a lot more healthy, a lot more vibrant, a lot more attractive to the people of the Donbass. I mean, this is one of the reasons why Crimea went without a whimper and quite the opposite. Because basically, perversely, and then it's a ghastly thought really, but to the people of Crimea, Russia looked like a better option than Ukraine. Well, you know, you need to make Ukraine look that much more
because of the neglect.
And then, then maybe by the time the next election cycle comes in, I mean, who knows what's going to be the situation in Moscow? Who knows how important Moscow will feel? It'll be a lot harder to actually rig the next one, and maybe then the next one is the one where you really put pressure on to make sure they're free and fair. So that's the political long game, and of course, there's also a military long game. You know, you spend a year, 2 years building up your military and retraining and reorienting. Because the Ukrainian military, the point is, never really had any proper reform process. It was basically just a little chunk of the Soviet military that just continued. So mm-hmm. it wasn't geared for the kind of operations we've seen in the Donbass. You spend 2 years, if need be, just ensuring that if it comes once again to a conflict, you have an army that isn't going to make the same kind of mistakes and put in, frankly, the same fairly miserable performance as we've seen this time. So, I mean, I do actually think that at this point, if I was sitting in Kiev, I think I would be thinking in terms of, well, there's a lot that we're going to have to swallow in the short term for longer-term goals. Mm-hmm. The question is, of course, whether or not Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk are willing to, in a way, think in those terms.
Natalia, what do you think that's Poroshenko's calculation? I think Mark spelled out a possible and very optimistic scenario there.
Well, I think it's a very interesting theoretic analysis. If we take into account that Ukraine is left alone and is being supported by the West in terms of reforms. But I think we tend to forget that this war was imposed by Russia on Ukraine and with the goals that President Putin has not achieved. So I think that we still have to see what his real goals were, and because he will have to explain it to his own population, which has been warmed up to the extent of hysteria now, that with all those labels of fascism and everything else in Ukraine. And now he will have to say that these fascists are going to have the local elections in Donetsk and we're friends again and everything else. So it will be difficult to go back from fighting for Putin himself, because everything is built up for long fight, for a big fight. He has been threatening with all-out war just a week ago, and now he's going to step back. It's very difficult for me to see how this is going to happen.
It's actually not that difficult for me to see it, because when you have complete control of the media, you can basically switch the narrative on a dime. And it's, you know, we've always been at war with Eurasia.
Well,
we've always been at peace with Eurasia.
He has to see a reward for that. He has to see a very big reward for that. What is it going to be? The scale down of sanctions? Or, well, the sanctions are still going to be, some of them are still going to be there, even for Crimea, because that is, he's never going to get back, to give back to Ukraine. So this is, I don't see how, what is the price for him for that?
Well, the price for him is going to be, his economy is going into the toilet.
That's a problem, because we know that it's been going there 2 years ago already starting. So, and he started this war in exactly to divert attention from the people, from the state of his economy. And now after the war, he gets nothing and the economy is even worse.
Yeah. Mark, yeah,
He gets the chance precisely because, as you say, he has control over the media. He can say, look, you know, we went in there not for geopolitical reasons, but because, you know, the poor babies of Donetsk and so forth. The fighting is over. The people of Donetsk now have a proper solution which will actually look after their interests and so forth. And at the same time, there will inevitably be a track B, which is turning to the West and saying, look, you know, if you want this to continue, you're going to actually have to sweeten the pot a bit for me. So I think we can expect a partial rollback of sanctions, which again allows him to say, you know, he won't call it a partial rollback of sanctions. He will say, you know, the West is now acknowledging them that their mistake and capitulating. And, you know, let's face it, the kind of sanctions that he will want to roll back are the systemic ones rather than necessarily the individual ones. Mm. If some people still can't get to and go and pat their dogs, he won't necessarily regard that as a crucial issue. So, I mean, I think he can package this absolutely as a victory if he wants to.
Yeah. Yeah, the question, and that's the million-dollar question. Before we move on, just I wanted to note one thing. I just, shortly before coming in the studio, I saw a pretty interesting video on YouTube. I don't know if any of you saw it. It was Poroshenko and Lukashenko talking on the sidelines of the conference in Minsk. It's clearly audible in Russian, where Lukashenko says, how is it going? Poroshenko goes, it's going very difficult. Referring to Putin, is playing a very dirty and very tricky game. And Lukashenko looks at him sympathetically and says, I know, we all know, we all understand. Did you ever think that Lukashenko would be the one saying, we all understand, me, Germany, and France, you know, against Russia, which tells you how much the world has changed over the past year. Well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and move a little bit into Mark's favorite territory, crooks, crime, and spooks, and look at how sanctions and Russia's economic crisis are affecting the world of criminals and the Siloviki. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. With me here in the studio is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFURL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Bonn, Germany is Andreas Umlan, a professor of Russian and Ukrainian history at Kiev Mohyla Academy and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kiev. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Силовикам предстоят сокращения. Всем правоохранительным органам предложено
госнаркоконтроль присоединить к полиции, чтобы оптимизировать расходы в органах власти.
Организация штатной структуры будет проводиться по тому же принципу, которого в МВД придерживается.
ФСБ сначала уволит гражданский персонал.
По которой ради Крыма будут сокращать сотрудников.
Сокращение на 15% от общей численности сотрудников ожидается.
Russia's economic crisis, it appears, is even hitting the Siloviki. Kommersant reported this week that the Interior Ministry, the Prosecutor General's Office, the Emergency Ministry, the Federal Anti-Narcotics Service, and even the FSB are facing staff cuts. The investigative committee has escaped staff cuts so far, but will be forced to cut expenses. And meanwhile, Mark tells me that there is evidence of growing grassroots corruption and sanctions-busting smuggling through Belarus. Mark, we're all on tenterhooks here. Fill us in on the dirty details of what's going on in the crime and Siloviki world.
Well, I mean, obviously at the moment we're still dealing with fairly scattered data points, but the interesting thing is that organized crime inevitably reflects what's going on. You know, the underworld reflects the upper world. And if we look back to, for example, the 2008 economic crisis, I mean, that clearly had a major impact on how organized crime operated within Russia. So, I mean, I think there's three interesting processes taking place that are worth dwelling on briefly. One is corruption. Again, I mean, it is difficult because obviously this is by definition an underground sort of activity. But some anecdotal evidence that's coming in is that not only are we seeing an increase in the kind of the grassroots corruption, you know, the fire inspector coming and looking at your shop and saying, it's a lovely shop here, it's a shame if it had to be closed down,
the normal stuff.
Well, but what's happening is, you might say, it seems to be shifting slightly in terms of obviously the intensity, but also what had happened is a lot of that kind of corruption had basically just become sort of a regular and understood business expense. Or even actually a positive thing in some ways. It was regarded as much as anything else facilitating. You want a permit to go through the mayor's office quickly. Well, you know who to pay. And in some ways, it's the sort of the equivalent almost of paying for, when you buy your airline ticket, paying to be able to have, you know, expedited service. You know, it just seemed to be almost as part of the menu of services. What we seem to be having now is a bit more of a shift towards just the purely parasitic or predatory kind of corruption. Not the, you can pay to get better service, but pay me or bad things will happen to you. Which again implies
which
that people
extortion.
Are actually... Exactly. Well, I mean, which is basically what we're seeing is that precisely people are finding a shortfall, and therefore they are making up the resources by just simply abusing their office. Now, on one level, well, that just simply is a sort of something to be filed under the it sucks to be a small business person in Russia. A very, very large, thick file. But I think what's interesting about that is, again, it affects state legitimacy. Because it is one of the crucial ways that people actually measure whether or not their state is working for them. People seem to basically had internalized the sort of the service-driven form of corruption. So this, I think, is once again going to make corruption more of an issue. And we know it's one of the issues in which actually, although people have tended to disarticulate how you feel about corruption with how you feel about the government, but it is definitely one of the potential flashpoints. So I think that's an interesting and telling sort of measure as much as anything else of the frictional impact of economic crisis on sort of day-to-day life in Russia. Second sort of corruption element is in terms of what it actually means for organized crime. Whenever we see new substantial opportunities emerge, gangs compete over who actually gets to exploit them. And this is the fascinating thing. We're seeing Belarus emerging. Again, you know, it's funny how Belarus keeps cropping up.
So I think Belarus is going to be one of the stories of 2015, actually.
Well, that's not one of those phrases you tend to hear. It'll be good to see that one emerge. But I mean, I think what we're seeing is a lot of smuggling coming into Russia, particularly of Russian sanction affected, you know, expensive food and that kind of thing. But also basically goods that are then either stolen, counterfeit, or just simply untaxed. Because there is still a very strong consumer demand in Russia, but increasingly people can't afford the goods, and therefore they're turning it basically once again to the black market to try and meet their needs at a cheaper cost. Now, what this means is obviously on the one hand that Belarus is sitting pretty, because obviously all the various kind of corrupt officials are also dipping their beak in the income flows. But it means that, you know, up to now it has to be said that the kind of gangs that had contacts with Belarus or that were on the Belarusian border, that was not exactly one of the kind of the hot areas. It's not as if, you know, had all the gangsters saying, but, you know, never mind the Afghan heroin flows into Western Europe. I got to get me a slice of the Belarus business. So now you have gangs that are sort of which were once upon a time fairly provincial backwater gangs that are actually doing really rather well. It shifts the balance of power in the underworld. It means that other gangs are thinking, well, no, actually, you know, now this might be an opportunity to meet our needs now
so
that we're feeling a squeeze elsewhere.
The big boys are looking toward Belarus.
Yeah, and again, why this is important
is
not. Well, it could. I mean, I think, you know, we see this often again. It's always difficult to call, but I think again it speaks to there's a lot of tensions within the Russian underworld. And, you know, in some ways, I think we're waiting. It might be this, or it might be something else in a year's time, or whatever. But we're waiting for the point when tension leads to us, you know, if I can mix my metaphors, creates a spark, which conflagrates a whole variety of other pressures that have really been building up. So definitely Belarus and the Belarus smuggling business is the one to watch. And the third and final point is, just at the time when there's increasing tension, there's more of a problem with corruption, there's more of a problem with smuggling, there's more of a problem not just with smuggling with Belarus, but also drug flows. Remember, Russia, biggest heroin consumer per capita in the world nowadays. Just at that time, again, because of the economic problems, we're seeing cuts in law enforcement. 10% cuts across the board, though I think it's interesting that it's worth saying that these cuts are slightly variegated. I mean, the FSB isn't actually being required to cut its personnel by 10%. It's given the choice of 10% cut in personnel or equivalent cost-cutting measures. So I think probably the FSB will either cut border troops, which are also part of its responsibility, or just find ways, because it has a very padded budget anyway. I don't really think the FSB is going to hurt. But on the other hand, the Federal Anti-Drug Service looks like, you know, increasingly the signs are that it's going to be wound up. It's already actually had to swallow a 15%
wound
cut
up,
in its
yeah?
personnel. Well, basically swallowed up by the Interior Ministry. Uh-huh. That's the current word. But so, you know, as an independent service, which is going to, you know, bulk up the Interior Ministry a bit, mean it requires, again, some more investigative capacities, which is precisely the opposite of the process we'd seen in the past, which means that, yeah, the Interior Ministry is obviously going to be sort of losing cops, and it's worth noting that at the moment the first signs are that it's going to lose beat cops, or rather is not recruiting more beat cops, but it's not going to be shrinking its interior troops, who are the internal security forces. Which again says something about Kremlin priorities. They want to have their sort of you know, head breakers, if need be, rather than people who are going to find a lost dog.
Right.
But on the other hand, it means that the Interior Ministry, which up to now has been, frankly, the piñata of all the other security agencies that they beat when they want to steal some sweeties, it looks as if it's going to be strengthened once again. Probably precisely because of concerns about security politics. That,
and,
you
know, the investigative committee is almost exempt from all of this, no?
Yeah, well, it's going to face cost cuts, but not personnel cuts. Mm-hmm. But again, I think the point is the investigative committee is anyway, in numerical terms, the smallest. If you shrink it much more, then it loses its weight. I think, again, you know, we're going back to the age of a stable triumvirate is the hope. You've got the Interior Ministry, you've got the Federal Security Service, and you've got the Investigative Committee all watching each other. So that says something, but, you know, we still have to work out who's going to end up running the Interior Ministry. Because there's still talk about maybe the Interior Ministry being replaced by Zolotov, deputy, who is a close Putin confidant. So again, I mean, I think that we're seeing a shrinkage, but actually increased Kremlin attention on actually how you manage the Siloviki.
So what does this all add up to, really? I mean, we're talking about an increase in organized crime, a potential gang war over the smuggling through Belarus, cuts across the board in the law enforcement agencies, except for the head crackers. What is this all adds up to a pretty volatile situation, it seems to me, no?
It does. I mean, again, I don't want to suggest that we're going to be seeing sort of dramatic actions happening next Thursday. But in terms of the general increase in tensions, I mean, this is evidence, I would suggest, that the economic crisis is having an impact on the ground. This is evidence that at some level it's actually beginning to have an impact on the Kremlin's instruments to control what happens on the ground. And when we sort of, or if and when, we see sort of tensions rising, I still think that one of the other potential stories of 2015 will be labor unrest.
Mm-hmm.
The capacity of the state neatly and efficiently to deal with it may well be impacted.
Mm.
And therefore, that means, unfortunately, then that's when you turn to your interior troops.
Natalia, as Mark, as you were writing, I saw Natalia, as you were talking, I saw Natalia writing, and she clearly has something to say.
Yeah, I was thinking about when you cut the official Siloviki, where do the unofficial Siloviki resurface? Are they going to resurface in Ukraine, in Donbass? Because this was the former Siloviki, the former Secret Service police and army people are the main pool of volunteers, of the Russian volunteers for food and bath. And these are the people who normally don't have anything else to do. They know how to use the guns. They don't know. They don't have any other profession. They don't. They didn't get any other employment in their life. So lots of those people did end up in Ukraine, and not only from Russia, but from other places in the former Soviet Union. So this really is a security concern for Ukraine.
Mark, here, you're the expert in this kind of stuff.
That's actually a really interesting question. Absolutely. I mean, they could well end up in the Donbass, either because, as it were, Moscow sends them, or just simply because of the workings of the market. There may well be opportunities for these kinds of people. I mean, I think really what we're going to see is, I mean, obviously a lot of people will just go, you know, in some cases, these staff cuts are just simply that they are not recruiting to fill vacancies that become available because of, you know, transfers and retirements and whatever. But, yeah, some people are going to be sacked. And therefore, some may end up in the Donbass. Some may well end up, and again, this doesn't preclude them also ending up in the Donbass, within the private security sector. And it's worth noting that Russia is actually now becoming much more engaged with the idea of actually creating mercenary organizations, which can also act as a proxy of the state. So it might well be that they just simply become a kind of a different kind of state arm. And some of them end up in the, quote, private sector, unquote, which is precisely the underworld, all ready to fight the potential new gang wars.
Right. Well, this gives us a great opportunity to pull things full circle. I structured this to give Mark his usual opportunity to shine on all themes Siloviki and crime-related. But basically, Natalia, if you remember correctly, last time you were on the program, we talked about a battle of governance between Ukraine and Russia. And in the first half, we basically talked a lot about, can Ukraine reform its governance under this Minsk agreement and under the threat of war? Mark just painted a picture of a nightmare of governance in Russia, basically, as a result of the economic crisis and sanctions. When you put all this together, and I'd like to hear from all of you on this, do we see another reason why Ukraine might win this war of governance, regardless of what's in that Minsk agreement?
Well, if given an opportunity, that's the main thing from the very beginning. Ukraine wanted to sign the association agreement with the European Union for good governance. Exactly. So that was the main reason why it didn't go through. So it's a serious underlying competition, and I think this is going to be the biggest issue for those countries. How you're going to manage your people, especially when it's going to be when Russia is going to be more realistic in terms of its economy, because before that it was pumped up on the oil money. Now it's going to be the real test for that.
Right. Andreas, what are your thoughts? Can Ukraine win this battle of governance, given this bleak picture Mark just painted of Russian law enforcement?
Well, I'm afraid Ukraine is in a bad position here. Russia is financially simply much stronger, and it can go a long way upholding its system of governance. I'm coming back here again to the issue of sanctions. The sad story about all of this is, of course, that the European Union is indirectly financing this Russian system of governments and also the Russian foreign adventures, because much of the money that is used to do all these things and to finance Transnistria, South Ossetia, Abkhazia, Crimea, the Donbass, is coming from oil trade with the European Union. And there have been voices in Germany which said that whereas there is a mutual dependency in the gas sector, there is actually much less dependency of Europe, of the European Union, from oil imports from Russia. And oil plays a much larger role also in the Russian state budget. So if now these problems are appearing in Russia with the cuts in funding for the Siloviki because of the low oil price, if the European Union would become more serious about its engagement for Ukraine, for Moldova and Georgia, it would use its leverage in the oil trade, and then there would have to be more cuts. And then, indeed, Ukraine, I think, would have a chance in winning this war of governments.
And we may well see that as we see LNG terminals being built in Lithuania and Poland, and in the future in Finland and in Estonia. And we may see the energy mix change in Europe, and this dependency in which would give Europe all the more leverage over Russia on this. So I hope you're right there. Mark, last word to you. Bring it all around for us.
Yeah, last word. Okay. I mean, in a way, I think I would want to pick up on something that Natalia said and something that Andrei said. I mean, Natalia said, given an opportunity, Ukraine can do it. Well, yeah, exactly, an opportunity, and that involves time, but above all, political will. We do need to see, actually, Ukraine willing to accept those governance challenges, which will mean short-term pain, because precisely, as Andrea said, I mean, Russia still is in a much, much stronger position. I mean, we mustn't suggest that Russia necessarily has it worse than Ukraine. Ukraine has a historic opportunity, but on the other hand, also a much, much worse situation. Russia can absorb the current costs for rather longer, unless and until something unexpected happens to sort of hit this kind of brittle structure. So really, in some ways, I think that it all now depends on whether or not the Ukrainian political elite, a Ukrainian political elite that have for years have failed every time they had an opportunity to carry out real state building, whether they're going to take this particular opportunity to do it. And I can hope so.
All right. Well, on that note, we will wrap it up because that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. With me here in the studio has been Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFURL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. And joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Bonn, Germany has been Andreas Umland, a professor of Russian and Ukrainian history at Kiev Mohyla Academy and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kiev. Thank you all for a fascinating discussion.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.